In the name of God, creator, redeemer, and giver of life. Amen. Please be seated. Earlier this week, I was leading our parish online evening prayer, and one of the readings was the story of Peter in the courtyard of the high priest after Jesus' arrest. Peter is challenged by onlookers, and he denies three times that he has any connection with Jesus. And then, of course, he realizes what he's done as the cock crows, and he breaks down and weeps bitterly. Our community reflected on this familiar, poignant text, and we found that many of us identified with Peter in this moment, in small and larger ways. One person told about being at a dinner party where several guests were convinced atheists, and they talked about how stupid religion is and how terrible their past church experience had been. Our friend did not, could not, speak about how important their relationship with God and faith and church is, or what it means in their life. They just sat and felt uncomfortable. Another talked about being at a family gathering where hateful opinions about immigrants were expressed. They didn't know how to disrupt the conversation and perhaps the familiar relationships, how to speak up for gospel love and justice in that moment. Yet another simply said, "It's scary these days to stand up for what I believe, and I struggle with what danger might really be for me and the others I care about." For all, there was a kind of a question about what is necessary, what is being polite, what is just going along, what is being afraid, what is being prudent, how do we discern? Later in the week, with these demands and choices and the costs of discipleship much on my mind, I listened to a friend talking about having to care for a suddenly ill parent. Despite careful planning, they said they felt absolutely pulled apart by the unexpectedly challenging needs and the important commitments they already have to their work, their ministry. The story was full of self-judgment and a sense of failure, even though this person is one of the most faithful people I know. There was a sense of simply not knowing how to prioritize in the midst of so many important competing claims. I don't know about you, but especially in these times, with this horrendous shooting in Minneapolis last week, the dismantling of public health and vaccine protocols by those who should safeguard them, ongoing attacks on our immigrant neighbors, relentless assaults on the natural world, and the continuing soul-sickening genocide in Gaza. It is easy to be overwhelmed with need and anger and grief. How are we called to love God and our neighbor, and yes, love ourselves too? It can be hard to discern what's ours to do on both the micro and the macro level. And it can be easy to feel that what we do doesn't matter, or that we're not doing enough. And then this Sunday morning, we hear these demanding words from Jesus. "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife, presumably also husband, and children, brothers and sisters, yes, and even life itself, cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." And then a little later, "None of you can become my disciple if you do not give up all your possessions." Is Jesus really talking about hating our closest family members? No, of course not. The whole gospel is about loving, It's about loving our neighbors, loving strangers, and even loving our enemies. And sometimes, indeed, it is those near relations who are the hardest to love, hardest to forgive, hardest to simply hold in goodwill. But more often, our families are the ones with whom we learn about love. We learn the joys and the hard work of loving and being loved. What Jesus is saying in a hyperbolic, striking way is that as important as these relationships are, and precisely because they are, it's vital that our deepest allegiance and trust are given to God and God's way of love and justice. Often we live this in the context of our families and partnerships and close friendships, and sometimes this first commitment puts us at odds with them. Maybe more telling, our own egos, our drive for self-preservation and self-importance, our own lives, our need to justify ourselves becomes the most important thing to us. Amassing things and wealth sometimes is a manifestation of both our ego and our fear. As Jesus says elsewhere, when we seek to save our lives in this clutching way, making self-protection and accumulation the goal, we lose what is essential. We lose the richness and the meaning of life in its fullness. That can only be experienced when we are prepared to spend our lives and our resources in generosity and love in the service of God's kingdom of mercy and healing and liberation. These sayings are meant to shock Jesus' first hearers, this large crowd, and they shock us too into considering our priorities. There are real choices to make, and for most of us, basing our lives on Jesus' way is a journey. It's an ongoing process of discernment and growth. I'm struck that Jesus' examples to the crowd that hears this hard saying are not about dramatic renunciation. Instead, they're stories about people who face demanding tasks and have to assess what resources they can bring to them in deciding whether to proceed. I noted the first particularly. Which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether you will have enough to complete it? As most of you know, we at Ascension are intimately familiar with this situation. We spent the last several years not exactly building, but repairing our tower just up there. This was not exactly a discretionary decision, since we were afraid that if the work were not done, falling brownstone might become a real hazard to the people walking by. We didn't necessarily have the money up front. We worked hard to raise it. We were fortunate. We faced significant delays and cost overruns despite our careful counting of the cost. We were blessed by the deep, repeated generosity of parishioners and friends and even strangers. The wardens and vestry and I did have some anxious times wondering if we could complete the work and what would happen if we couldn't. Thank God, it's done. In light of this gospel, though, I find myself thinking not only about our experience of counting the cost, but also I ask, what is it for? I ponder the priorities we had, restoring our tower, using our money that way, and the responsibility we have not only to steward this lovely sacred space that past generations have left us, but also our responsibility to use our buildings and all our resources for the work of the gospel, especially in these times. That means our worship, of course. It means opening our doors wide for our neighbors, to pray for respite, for beauty and sanctuary. Our wonderful open door volunteers do this every weekday. It means nourishing our faith so that we can strengthen our witness, offering programs like our pantry that serve our community. It includes making space available for other important ministry like the 12-step meetings here or the immigrant rights clinic we are contemplating. It means caring for one another, eating and laughing and crying and singing and learning and growing together so that we can do the hard and beautiful work that God gives us to do. It calls for continuing discernment together about priorities and resources and what is ours to do in the service of love and justice in our neighbors. It requires hard work and trust in God's abundant care and provision. Some of those who hear the words of Jesus are called to leave everything and travel with him. This was true of his early close companions, and it's true for some Christians today. Others are not so called. In the New Testament, I think about Mary and Martha, who we heard about earlier this summer. They stayed home, but they welcomed Jesus for meals and conversation and much needed rest. Later this fall, we'll hear about Zacchaeus, who gave away half his immense fortune to the poor, but he still had plenty to use in other ways. We've heard about folks that Jesus healed, but he said, "Don't follow me, go home and tell your family what you've experienced." No matter what, this text calls all of us, both individuals and communities, to orient and reorient our lives and the use of our resources to the work of discipleship, following Jesus. All of us have the call to change our lives, to grow in grace, to walk the way of love, whether it keeps us right where we are or leads us far away. In that process, sometimes we make mistakes, even big ones. We need help from God and from our community. We learn how to forgive and how to seek forgiveness. We learn how to forgive ourselves, which can free us to persevere in the work of love. This brings me to the follow-up story of Peter's denial. You know it, of course, that wonderful Easter story of breakfast on the beach. After the horror of the crucifixion and the unsettling joyful confusion of the resurrection, the disciples have gone back to fishing in Galilee. They labor all night, but they don't catch anything until a stranger on the shore tells them to put their nets down on the other side, and they pull in an immense catch and then begin to recognize Jesus. Jesus has prepared fish and bread for them on the shore, and he feeds them after they bring in their boat and their bursting nets. After breakfast, Jesus and Peter have a conversation. Looming in the context is Peter's epic failure as a disciple, his guilt and his shame about what happened in that courtyard. But neither of them addresses it directly. Rather, echoing the threefold denial, Jesus says to Peter three times, "Do you love me?" With increasing frustration and desperation, Peter says in the affirmative, "Yes, yes," until the third time he cries, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." And Jesus does know. He knows the failure and the shame and the trauma and the love. Somehow through this conversation, Jesus' repeated question and invitation, once again, to care for my sheep, there is grace beyond measure at work in the depths of Peter's life and being. We don't know exactly how, but it opens up a way out of no way. Peter changes. This moment resonates for me with today's psalm, with its remarkable affirmation of the mystery and inexhaustible divine knowing in which we are grounded, in which we are held and sustained and nourished. O God, you have searched me out and known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You trace my journeys and my resting places and are acquainted with all my ways. You press upon me behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain it. The psalmist celebrates God's presence, both intimate and infinite, accompanying them from their mother's womb to beyond this life. They cannot escape that presence. God is with them wherever they go, even to the depths of hell. Being known like this is unsettling, but it is grace-filled. They and we are known in joys and sorrows, in dark secrets and dearest hopes and proudest achievements, in the wholehearted yes, in struggling doubts, in yearning towards love, towards God, towards life in its fullness. There is a hymn which we are not singing today that speaks of being freely loved, though fully known. Being freely loved, though fully known, they and we are called to daily life-changing discipleship. To Peter and to us, Jesus says, "Feed my sheep. Be my heart, hands, and presence in this terribly hungry and broken world. Choose my love again and again." It's out of that wonder and goodness that we are called to follow Jesus, for our sake and for the sake of the world. It's not that the call is not challenging. Of course it is. It asks everything of us, and it offers life in its fullness. I will close with a prayer from the poet and pastor, Laura Martin. It's called "Blessing Before the Hard Thing." Blessing before the hard thing. Go, remembering the waters of your baptism that marked you beloved. Go, remembering the hand you held when you were a child and afraid, and the time you took someone else's hand when they trembled. Go, remembering the flowers given to you on other days with no sun. Go, remembering the words someone spoke to you that let you see your light again, and the words you gave out as bread to someone hungry. Go, holding on to the one who has always held you. Amen.